Welcome to Tech Talk from RNIB Connect Radio, the RNIB's technology show for blind and partially sighted people. See technology differently.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk here on RNIB Connect Radio. A special episode this week celebrating GAD, as we call it. That's Global Accessibility Awareness Day. And with me to talk it over the next hour, I have my favourite guest in the whole wide world. Well, one of them anyway, Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet. Hello, Robin.
I was going to say, I think somebody else in your house has something to say about that.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. I said guest on Tech Talk. Just want to be clear on this. But I did say one of, because I have my other favourite guest, who also happens to be called Robin. This will be fun. Robin Spinks from RNIB. Hello to you, sir.
You're such a charmer, Stephen. It's great to be with you both.
Absolutely. I am full of it, as they say. And it is great to be here. And we're all doing this from home, obviously. We're all social distancing. Where are you in the world at the moment, Robin?
I'm on the sunny east coast of Scotland, about 4 miles north of Edinburgh Castle, in the commuter town of Dalgetty Bay, on the South Coastal Pass.
Anything with Bay in the name is good, I think. That is just, it conjures up some beautiful imagery, I think.
I was talking the other day to someone about the bridge, which is, of course, the Forth Road Bridge, and the bay. And they assumed, right, quite understandably, that because I was talking about the bridge and the bay, they just assumed that I was in San Francisco. You know, to do a little check.
Well, you are, just with more rain.
And less fog.
And less fog, exactly. Where are you in the world today, Robin? Christofferson. Yeah, Robin 1, I think we'll call you this Robin 1.
Oh, can't I be Robin 2?
No, you can be Robin 1.
Oh, okay.
We can swap.
Yeah.
Halfway through
that's
swap.
Just going to be, that's a recipe for disaster. So, Warwick. Sunny Warwick. The castle is still standing after so many hundreds of years, and it's lovely.
Is that the one you're in?
No.
I always have the impression of you in a castle. You know this. I'm on the west coast of Scotland in a little village called Stonehouse, which is just south of Glasgow. And it's warm today. And I have to say, whatever the temperature is in the city, it is always about 3 degrees below out here. And today it's actually about 23. It's really, really nice. So yeah, As we sit here, it's actually very pleasant. I should be doing this outside. Why didn't I think about this? We should have recorded this outside. But we are here to talk about and celebrate Global Accessibility Awareness Day, because it is that opportunity, guys, isn't it, to really allow, well, for companies to allow themselves to talk about all the great things that they've done to make their products more accessible. And over the course of this hour, I don't want to look back too much. I want to look forward, because there's so much good stuff going on. And actually, we could fill the hour just on this alone. And that's what I think we should do. So, Robin Spinks, I want to come to you first on this, because RNIB does an incredible amount of work. And a lot of people don't know about this work, because a lot of it is under the hood. A lot of it is ongoing. So I know there's things you can't tell us. But I think it is safe to say that RNIB works with a huge range of manufacturers and companies to really encourage them, and that's putting it nicely, but yeah, to encourage them to make their products accessible. And we're going to talk about one key example of that in a moment in the form of a washing machine. But could you maybe tell us a bit more widely about what RNIB does in this space?
Yeah, so innovation and technology has been part of the work of RNIB for a long time. I've only been around 10 years at RNIB. But, you know, during that time, we've worked across a huge range of products and services. So everything from, you can imagine, cash machines and the software that they run on, right through to domestic showers, believe it or not. There's an accessibility and inclusion design element in designing a shower, because it's going to be used in lots of different environments, lots of different settings, right across to websites and apps and devices which, I guess, incorporate a range of digital services. So if you think about something like a smart TV, or if you think about the notion of smart television now, it's not so much about a device and that device being accessible. It's actually about a meshed experience of hardware, software, and services. So that's increasingly what we're finding ourselves dealing with, is not just one entity that might be one part in the delivery chain, but actually hardware, software, and services running together and the need for all of that to create an accessible experience. So you're quite right, we're invited by manufacturers and developers of products and services. Sometimes we go out and do, you know, some marketing, we do some advocacy work across the world with technology companies, and that leads to assignments that we have with many of the leading technology brands to build accessibility in. And of course, it's not just accessibility for people who are blind or partially sighted. Yes, that's the specialism that we obviously represent. But, you know, any product or service is going to be deployed in a market where people with disabilities will use it. And the legislation that exists around the world is obviously pan-disability. So we have to take a broad approach to thinking about how we make products and services inclusive. And it's ever-changing, you know, just when you think you've got on top of a sector or a product segment, something else comes along in the form of disruption and it changes everything and presents new challenges. So there's never a dull moment.
And at AbilityNet, Robin, you do something similar, don't you? Because obviously you are working with companies as well. That is essentially your focus there as an organization, is on business. What do you do in the technology space?
Yeah, so we unfortunately don't get to kind of help companies work with tangible goods, with atoms and molecules and stuff, but we do with bits. Actually, having said that, one time we did a project with a bank on their card reader, their accessible card reader. So people that wanted the accessible one would tick a box and they would get one that was self-voicing and it had much bigger buttons and stuff like that. So one time we did, but mostly it's helping organizations with their digital properties, so their websites, their apps, their comms, you know, when they send out communications to customers or do marketing campaigns or tweets or whatever it might be, making sure that those things are inclusive. Most of our work that is paid work is with corporate entities. Well, we do consultancy services for anyone that would come, but it's mostly the corporates that have the budget. And that's how we pay for the free services to disabled individuals. So helping people with their tech at home, manning our free phone number and our inquiries at abilitynet.org.uk email address. And it's such a broad remit that we have, you know, all areas of technology and all areas of disability, and certainly not just, you know, disability with a capital D. It could be anything. It could be eye strain on a Friday afternoon, or, you know, you've broken your wrist or whatever and you need to get solutions. But actually, we would encourage people to play with the settings on their devices. No one should settle for a vanilla experience with their tech. And we can certainly have a lot to say about that. In fact, there's a brilliant resource that we have created with the help of Microsoft called mycomputermyway.com. And if you go there, then everyone can look at the main platforms, Windows, Mac, iOS and Android, and have step-by-step instructions on how to, you know, change those settings, etc. And unlike most online places where you could go to for that kind of information, it doesn't just say click here or tap here. It gives you the keystroke alternative example as well, and all the screenshots are properly labeled and all that sort of thing. So we think that's a really useful resource too. But yeah, I'd love to be able to play with washing machines and stuff like that as well.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned that, because, you know, we've talked so much on Tech Talk about phones and smart speakers and computers generally, and to some degree, smart televisions. But it's about that point where it gets a little bit grey in the area, because there's accessibility and then there's usability and all of that that gets built in that can be problematic. So, you know, let's not talk about them as problems. Let's just agree they're challenges, because I think they are, and I think you both of you would agree with that, that this is all just a challenge that needs to be overcome. It's not a problem that can never go away. So, you know, Robin Spinks, let me ask you about this, because I want to ask you specifically about the Miele washing machine. This is a new washing machine that's been produced for blind and partially sighted people. That's what it says on Miele's website. And we were really excited to learn about it here at Tech Talk. And then, of course, we had the RNIB were involved as well. So maybe you could talk us through how you're helping companies like Miele make their technology accessible. But not only that, actually promote it in the mainstream environment as well.
Yeah, I mean, as you'd imagine, with any product or service, there's a lead time from, you know, becoming involved with a manufacturer. Sometimes our involvement begins at the outset, where we're involved in the design of the product and the development of it, and then ultimately marketing. Very often, though, it's maybe one segment of that. So work has already commenced. They want some consultancy. They maybe want to market the product via our channels, via our online shop. I guess the entry point to our interaction with companies varies quite significantly. And the Miele example is a really interesting one, because this is a bestseller product that Miele have. And what they've done essentially is to customize the front end of that product in a manual way to make it much more usable for blind and partially sighted people. So I guess it's more of an engineering approach to a hardware product to make it more usable. And this is something that was initially trialed in Germany, and it's had really successful reviews and positive reviews from the blind and partially sighted community. And through our work with Miele, we started to talk to them about this becoming available in the UK. And I'm happy to say that it is launching in the UK, and it will be available from the RNIB shop from August. So we're very excited about that. Lots of people tell us that laundry management is a challenge when you've got sight loss, particularly if you've had full vision and you've lost your vision. It can be really challenging as a kind of daily life activity that people tend to just take for granted that they'll get on with. But imagine for a moment trying to sort out your washing, put it on different cycles, manage it all. If you didn't have useful sight, it could be a challenge. And that's really where this product is kind of aiming to make things easier.
So no more excuses for any of us to say, I can't do the washing today because I don't know how to use the washing machine. That excuse is gone. Thanks, Robin. But no, seriously, this is an amazing development, and it's great to see, because I think it has to start somewhere. That's what we've always found. A fire has to be lit somewhere. Robin Christofferson, for you, you know, as a person, not just working at AbilityNet, but as a blind guy, you know, having the access to this technology is key. But, you know, you want the latest, you want the greatest mainstream tech, don't you?
I want a mixture. I want to be complicated and demanding. So if a low-tech solution will do, then actually I wouldn't mind that. So I wouldn't mind being able to go mainstream. I mean, I'm a cheapskate, so if I can go mainstream...
He is, Robin. Know, he really is.
Not expensive. Then, and stick some bump-ons on, then brilliant. And the washing machine version I had when I was living on my own sufficed in that regard. I only had two bumps at the two different temperatures. It was a nice dial and there was a button to get it going. But I wasn't using the level of sophistication that the machine had by any means. And I probably had pink, you know, clothes as a result. I don't know. But if I can then go to the complete other end of the spectrum and say I love super cutting edge stuff, preferably Alexified, so that, you know, you don't have to actually touch the machine at all or deal with its interface, touchscreen interface usually these days, but still get a lot of good functionality out of it just by talking to the air, then yeah, I'd love that as well. But things go wrong. You know, you have to set them up, and often you need a pair of eyes to help with the initial setup process of these smart connected devices. Sometimes the internet goes down, or the connectivity between the two devices, between the Echo, say, and the smart oven or whatever it is, goes down. And, you know, that doesn't happen with a device like this, where you've got a special interface. It's always going to be reliable, be consistent. And I still do have that talking microwave, which I use every day as well. So, you know, there's definitely, yeah. Top tip, if people have a Cobalt microwave that suddenly starts sounding like it's possessed and you have to instantly turn it off at the wall because the noise that's coming out of the little speaker is horrendous. And then when you switch it back on at the wall, it says, version 2.8, and then it suddenly goes back into the horrible screeching again and you have to instantly turn it off. My advice is persevere, because sometimes you have to turn it off 25 times.
What?
And on the 26th time, it'll come up talking. And we've had to do that for about 6 years now. And it's still going strong. And it only happens once every few months. But so if that does happen to your cobalt microwave, then persevere is my answer.
Can we really label that as a top tip?
It's top tip.
It's going to save you 25 times.
Seriously, it is that many times. But luckily, this Miele washing machine isn't going to create horrible feedback like that. So I'm sure this one is going to be far more consistent and hopefully will last, you know, a very long time because it's German.
Robin Spinks, I'll come to you on this. You've obviously worked with the company. You've had these relationships. Can you talk to us about the machine? Because when I read about it, it talks about audible beeps, which, you know, for example, if you turn the temperature up or you change the temperature, then you'll get a higher beep, and then lower, you'll get a lower beep, and so on. But no spoken feedback. Is there any kind of reason behind that, or is it because the audible beeps are enough?
So I should say that I'm yet to physically try the UK version of this device.
Okay.
However, my understanding is that it has tactile markings and raised lines and symbols across its fascia to kind of guide people through a range of settings. And then it has a large rotary dial with 12 individual wash programs, which are indicated by dots. It also uses acoustic indications, so each program selection setting is accompanied by a specific signal for smooth operation. So, you know, I think one of the things I would say is that this is coming from an engineering company who have got a really good track record for creating usable and really functional items that are very solid. My expectations are high, let's just say that. And I have yet to get a full hands-on with the UK product. But certainly my understanding from the German blind and partially sighted organisations who've looked at it and indeed used it is that people found it to be a really good solution. But, you know, I think Robin makes a really interesting point there, in the sense that I think lots of people want maybe one solution. They want the simplest thing possible. I think there are quite a few of us who want a high-tech solution and a really simple solution. And it's a good way to describe, you know, overcoming some of the challenges, because people often think, well, let's make it as simple as possible, but then you don't have the advanced functionality that you rightly might want, you know, if you're using a machine like this. So I think this Miele collaboration is one example of where we are collaborating to bring about greater accessibility. I've mentioned before working with Amazon as well on a variety of products and ideas. And really, from our perspective, we work with any company who approaches us and who wants to engage in creating a more accessible product. You'll note the Samsung television work over the last few years, which has created, you know, an accessible interface on Samsung Smart TV. But it's one part of the challenge. You know, I think we've got to make sure that we kind of allow people the option to have a simple experience if that's what they want, but also allow them to have a more sophisticated kind of in-depth experience that is actually tailored to what it is they want to achieve. So, you know, there's an interesting point in there too, if I might pick it up, about mainstream and specialist technology. And I think people often say, you know, and a simplistic analysis of the current climate is that mainstream technology will one day do everything for us. And I would argue that that's not the case. I think we're seeing a lot of examples of where mainstream technology is continuing to add value and remove barriers and open up access. But we're still seeing some brilliance in the specialist AT sector, where people can create bespoke solutions that really enable people to go further and to do more. And we need to be really cognizant of that. But I think both of those industries have got their place and have a future. Certainly that would be my steer.
Yeah, I've got to say my view on this has changed a lot in the last few years, just because of my own vision challenges. And I've felt that before my sight got as bad as it is now, I felt that you know, specialist tech was just, you know, it was one of those things that, yeah, okay, it was there, but it just seemed overpriced and it was too much. And can't I just get my iPhone to do it all? But, you know, it's funny when your site gets to a level where you start to, you know, recognize the benefits of, you know, tactile buttons, real buttons on, say, the Victor Reader Stream, which, you know, is a great device. And yes, I can do all this on my iPhone, but actually that quick, easy access is better on that device, on the Victor Reader. Or when it comes to Braille, you know, now I'm reading Braille, I'm using all the tech that goes with that, and I'm loving the new kit that's coming from Orbit, because, you know, that is affordable. I mean, we're seeing this year a huge shift in costs around Braille technology, which I think is going to create a new challenge. I think that the conversation for me has shifted between what it used to be, which was specialist versus mainstream. Now I think it's actually specialist and specialist, because we have companies like the Orbit Research Organization that are ploughing lots of money into developing low-cost Braille displays. We're going to see the new Orbit Reader 20 Plus this year, the Orbit Reader 40, and the Orbit Writer, which I'm really excited about. That's the little keyboard, which is basically for your iPhone.
It's pretty cool.
It is very cool. It sounds amazing, and I am absolutely buying one of those when they appear in the UK, or I might just have a friend in the States send me one. But, you know, either way, I want one, because they are really, really cool. And $99. And when you think about it, for a Braille keyboard, some might say that's a lot of money. I don't think it is. I think it's actually a pretty decent amount, considering what a Braille display costs. But even a Braille display is $499 from Orbit. So, you know, you're starting to see those prices come down, and I think the competition in that market is going to change. That can only be a good thing. So I think we're at a really exciting time, and I agree with you, Robin. I think we're in a really good place with this, and I don't think we should be in a position of discussing whether or not specialist is good or bad versus mainstream is good, being good or bad. I don't think that's fair. I think all of us have now come to the conclusion it's the right tool for the job. If you find an app does it just as well, great. And I did a feature once about Kurzweil 1000, the scanning software, versus VoiceStream Scanner, which is a $7.99 app on the App Store. And, you know, people were really annoyed at me doing this, because they're like, how can you put software that's around £1,000 versus an app at £8? But actually, there are clear differences between them. And I was trying to showcase that to say, but actually, there are good reasons why you'd want to spend £1,000 here, depending on your needs. But equally, if you just want to read a letter from time to time, spend the £8. The point is, here are the options that are available to you. Yeah. I'm not saying one or the other. I'm saying there are options, and we need to be aware of all of them. That's what this show's about.
There's a really lively debate in the blind community at the moment about Braille note takers, you know, specialist devices versus a Braille display with a standard laptop, or, you know, connected to your phone, etc. So there's nuances here versus in specialist versus mainstream, because, you know, something like a Braille display, I think, is always going to be a specialist device. I can never see that being built into a standard one, or, you know, manufactured by Microsoft or Apple or something like that.
Well, so, in fairness, the only thing I would say there is there's a possibility, and I don't know what you both think of this, and I think we're talking way down the line, but at some point, perhaps, there may be some kind of ability for devices like an iPad, say, to
have tactile. Yeah.
So perhaps Braille could emerge from that tactile display. I don't know. Maybe that's nonsense, but it wouldn't surprise me if that came around down the line.
Well, the haptic engine is so sophisticated on the iDevices these days that, you know, you really do feel like as you're moving your finger around the screen, if you've got it set up that way, and I would recommend that people do, as you move from control to control or element to element, you get that lovely tap under your finger. Whether that could go to the extent of having, you know, the impression of having six dots under your finger, I don't know. But yeah, I mean, who knows where technology is going to go. But at the moment, yeah, the idea of do you have a specialist, quite expensive Braille note taker versus a more affordable, much more affordable often, Braille display, where you've got a more complicated, arguably, device attached to it, a full laptop or, you know, iOS or whatever it might be, but that has, you know, a lot of potential in it. And obviously you can swap out the device whilst keeping the same Braille display, so you could potentially remain more current as well. So there are lots of issues there, but certainly in the disabled world more broadly, there's never going to be that the need for specialist assistive technology is never going to go away. If you have motor difficulties and you need a very specialist controller to control a computer or your wheelchair, etc., that's, you know, always going to be a specialist thing. And there's going to be organizations like Remap who will always be needed to actually fill in the gaps where even, you know, somebody's disability is so specific to their, you know, their particular physical needs are so specific that they need to have a special bit of kit, bespoke, you know, custom made for them. So we're definitely going to see that. And, you know, whilst Microsoft, for example, brought out the accessible game controller, that really opened up gaming for so many people with different disabilities, because it had the ability, you know, it had much bigger buttons, it had far more variability in its settings, it had the 10 ports, I think, into which you could connect different switches. So if you can't, you know, do a trigger with your finger, then you can do it with your knee or your, you know, puff down a tube or bang it with your head, whatever it might be. And actually that was a massive hit with able-bodied gamers as well, because it actually improved their gaming because of its flexibility, its ergonomics. You know, it actually prioritized ergonomics and usability over, you know, sleek and sexy, which is, you know, we all know that an iPhone, for example, is like a bar of soap when it, you know, if you just hold one without having it in a case, etc. So, you know, they certainly prioritized form over function in some aspects of the iPhone. I mean, just having the two lots of buttons opposite each other on the sides of the phone is a case in point, really. That isn't a good design. So, you know, things like that. But I think we're always going to need specialists, but the choices in the mainstream, and this is a huge feature of, you know, the last 9 years of GAAD, we've seen a massive increase in the choice that disabled people can have if they want to stay mainstream. And that's been hugely empowering.
Yeah, I mean, it's been incredible. And I think also we have to say in the specialist field as well, there are some amazing, and you're saying this earlier, Robin Spinks, you know, that there are some amazing developments there as well. And I mentioned Braille as one, but, you know, we're seeing cameras getting better and better, which means desktop video magnifiers are getting better. They're getting smarter as well. We're seeing more handheld devices with really high quality screens. You know, these are tools which, you know, I always think are really great to have. Yes, I know I've got my iPad and I could do it on that, but what if you don't have an iPad? What if you don't have an iPhone? What if you don't want these things? What are the options for you? I mean, in the mobile phone sense, we've got the Blindshell Classic mobile phone, which is a brilliant device, and it's so easy to use, so functional. Everything speaks on it, and it's got the classic T9 keyboard. So again, wonderful piece of technology that has just made a difference, because it's filled a gap that just was, you know, sitting there open. Nobody was filling it. I mean, very close to it with Doro, but it didn't quite get that far. And then we're hearing about new products from In Your Pocket as well coming soon. So there's lots and lots of interesting developments going on in this specialist space, I think.
There's a really interesting point there about, I think, what is almost the sort of second definition of the mainstreaming of accessibility. So people used to talk a few years ago about the mainstreaming of accessibility. And I think, you know, the situation Robin just described there with the Microsoft controller, that's almost kind of the whole notion of accessibility going mainstream being redefined. You know, the mainstream public recognize that things like the universal Xbox controller just makes gaming easier. It makes it better and more fun and more engaging, in the same way that if you've got an iPhone and you turn on bold text, for example, whether or not you've got an eye condition, it makes it easier to use. You know, so there's a sense in which accessibility features, some of them anyway, are kind of seeping out of accessibility and becoming regarded as just improvements to general ease of use and, you know, a more enjoyable, more immersive experience. And I think that's a fascinating kind of one for us to watch as that continues to happen. And I would put haptics in the same basket as well, in the sense that, you know, the newer generation haptic motors that are going into phones, like the most recent iPhones and Pixels, you know, they're incredibly capable. And actually, in a noisy environment, that's the difference between you wondering whether your payment has gone through when you go to pay contactless for something, and whether it hasn't. You know, the definition is given to you by the haptic experience. If you're fortunate enough to be able to see the screen, that's great. That will confirm that too. If you're very lucky to be able to hear it as well, then you'll get a confirmation. But, you know, being able to have haptic, visual, and auditory confirmations delivered all at the same time, it just underlines that sense in which, you know, accessibility features are being adopted by lots of people and being seen as really beneficial.
You bring up a really interesting point there, Robin, and it is a question that's on my mind about accessibility settings in general. I remember, and I've used this story I don't know how many times, but I think it really highlights something to me. I was on a train, this feels like about a million years ago now. Remember those days we got on trains?
What's a train? Yeah.
Those are gone. And now, actually, do you know, the only good thing about this whole virus thing is that I'll actually get a train carriage to myself, which is what I've always wanted. But, you know, other than that, if I ever get on a train again, that is. But I remember the last time I was on one, and I remember sitting across from this lady who was having real problems. She was talking to her daughter, and she was saying, well, I assumed it was her daughter, didn't ask her, get in trouble. But she was having real issues using her phone, and she said, I can't see the screen, just can't read it. And I said, excuse me, and I told her about accessibility settings. And she said, oh, I've seen that, but I don't go there because I don't think that's for me. And I thought it was a really interesting comment. You know, I don't go there because it's not for me, because accessibility is for other people. It's about disability. And I wonder if, and I'm not suggesting we change the name, but I think you're right, Robin, that a lot of these features have started to seep out into other parts of the operating systems. I noticed this on iOS, on iPhones in particular. And I've even read articles from people who are actually quite annoyed that certain keyboard functions or certain mouse pad or touch or trackpad or touchpad, especially with the new iPad now, with touchpad, you know, they're having real issues finding the settings because they're kind of littered all over the place. And I don't know what the answer to that is, but is it maybe, or is it now, or is there maybe a time in the near future where we actually see the accessibility itself disappear and all the features just become part of the operating system, so that wherever you are, if you're under keyboard settings, you'll get all those settings. If you're under display, that will feature all the high contrast options as well, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the term personalization, you know, and for me, that's what it should be about. Whether or not you consider yourself to be a person with a disability or a disabled person or have an impairment, however you consider it, or maybe you just don't recognize it at all, but you need to have bigger text, or you need a dark theme, or you need to have some other adaptation to the interface. Really, personalization is what it's all about. And I think that feels like the direction of travel in a way. Make the interface work in a way that is optimal for you, recognizing that it might be quite different for Robin and it might be different for me as well.
I mean, I was very happy when Apple brought accessibility up to the top level under settings in iOS 13 in this last year. So, but I was saddened when you said that lady said, you know, I don't want to go in there. That's not for me. So maybe it needs to be renamed, but at least bringing it up out of general has given it a level of visibility that it's never had before. With regards scattering those around within the other settings, I mean, something like display, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's, you know, got an area in there where you can make the text slightly bigger. But if you want to really bump it up, or indeed use magnification, then you have to go into under accessibility. Yeah. So a bit of cross signposting would be good. So,
but that's the problem, isn't it? Because it almost zones an area off. I think some people almost feel like, I used to use the term, you know, you don't need a radar key to get into accessibility on a phone. You know, you don't need a special key or a password, or, you know, what's the disability password this week? It's not like that. You know, it's open to everybody. And I think that having those zones where it's kind of zoned off isn't necessarily a great thing going forward. But I, you know, just to your point, and sorry to interrupt you, but just to your point, I totally agree. I'm so glad Apple brought accessibility up into the main part of the settings window. But sorry, please, I interrupted you.
No, absolutely. So I would like to see further, you know, I'd like an extension of that would be that in all the areas where a certain amount of customization is would be appropriate for everyone, like making your text slightly larger, there would then be a call to action if they needed to, you know, want it even larger still, tap here, and that would take you into the relevant part in settings in the accessibility section. And I think I've mentioned this on Tech Talk before, but Alison Sheridan, who does an Apple podcast, a lovely lady, she once did a mind map of the accessibility, no, of the settings app, the settings on your iOS device. For people that don't know, a mind map is like a great sprawling kind of spider affair, a diagram where you can visualize a very complex situation like the settings app, for example. And the accessibility section was bigger than all the other sections put together.
Wow.
So it's a monster, which, you know, really does talk to the priority that Apple gives accessibility. But to scatter those amongst the other setting, the other areas fully might actually swamp the other areas. So yeah. I think the cross signposting would be really good, and definitely agree with Robin that, you know, personalization or something that really invites people to go in and explore. And potentially, and this is very un-Apple, so I don't know if they do it, a button that says reset or kind of undo. Because one thing that's very disconcerting if you're new to iOS or Mac OS is that there's no kind of apply button. Every change you make is instant, and you then just go back. You know, you don't have to okay something to actually apply those changes. So that can be really disconcerting and probably off-putting if people wanted to mess around with accessibility. I know that my wife got VoiceOver on accidentally the other day, and because Screen Curtain was on as part of that, because I do use her phone occasionally, she couldn't get out of it because she didn't know what she'd done. So that can be a real fear for people.
And of course, how many, I don't know about you guys, but I've read so many articles. If you actually Google, you know, VoiceOver on iPhone or something, you actually find most of the articles are from forums, from people saying, how do I turn this thing off? In fact, you know, if I've had a bad experience in a store, what I used to do is turn on accessibility on as many products as I could, knowing fine well that they can't turn it off.
I did tell you that story, I think, at some point, didn't I, that we actually went in one Monday afternoon to every Apple store in London, and we turned on the accessibility features on every single device we could get our hands on.
Wow.
And then promptly left the store. And the reason we did it is that we'd had an email from a customer saying, I really like Apple, love the product, but the staff in store, they were really friendly, but they just didn't know enough about accessibility. So we sent that on to Apple. And then we went out that afternoon, went to all the London Apple stores, turned accessibility VoiceOver on everything, and then just left the store. And within hours of doing that, we had an email from Cupertino saying, do you guys offer any kind of training for customer service staff in understanding accessibility? And we thought, job done. Great, let's get on this train. And I have actually told Apple that. Actually, I told them a few years later. They thought it was hilarious. But, you know, sometimes you've got to just catalyze people into action in a creative way. And, you know, my point in that all along is that accessibility is not just for, you know, Stephen and Robin and Robin and the other visually impaired people and others with disabilities. It's actually for everyone. And even if you're not using accessibility features today, you may well be using them tomorrow. So it would be great if you knew about them.
Well, it is interesting. It's that continuity thing. So I think if someone is told today that they're losing their sight, okay, there's a lot of things on their mind at this point, right? And probably using an iPhone isn't up top. But at some point, you're going to want to have a conversation about using technology. And you'll probably think, I mean, just a straw poll I did on a train once, again, on a train. I used to travel on trains all the time. And, you know, I used to say to people, if you lost your sight tomorrow, do you think you could use your phone? And they said, no. And pretty much en masse, no, I don't think I can. No, of course I can't, because how would I know what to do? And when I just showed them VoiceOver for a couple of seconds, they were absolutely blown away that it was still possible to do it. So the idea of that continuity, you know, so even if it's taking that fear away of sight loss to some degree, although obviously, I'm not minimizing it to say, oh, well, you can use an iPhone, so life is great. It's not, of course not. But at the same token, there are some small benefits out of it, and that is one of them, that you would still be able to use a lot of the technology you use today, just maybe a slightly different way. But Robin, you bring up that point about the way you sort of got Apple's attention, and I get a lot of emails about this to the show, And I'm actually mindful of an email we've got in the bag at the moment. We haven't read out on air, and I don't have it in front of me right now. But the reason I mention it is because the theme of it comes up a lot. And that is whether or not it's appropriate for RNIB to perhaps be a little bit more, what's the word I'm looking for? Be a bit more upfront
vocal
with companies. Yeah, a bit more vocal, especially about those who aren't doing so well in the accessibility space. Is it time for RNIB to start naming and shaming, for example, companies that don't do so well, to prod them into action, to say, look at great examples over here, these wonderful companies that have done this great work. You've not done anything. You've not made your product accessible. It's not good enough. You know, be a bit more adversarial about it. Is that something that you think RNIB should do, or do you think the current approach is working well enough?
I think it's a really good point. And I think, as with anything that we do, it needs to be, the community need to be at the heart of it. So, you know, if someone contacts us and says, look, I want to do an email to X company because I just think they need to up their game on accessibility, we will help them with that in any way that we can. And equally, if they want to copy us into it or include us in it, we will do that. We often do send speculative emails and do speculative calls to companies where things have fallen short. You know, clearly what we can't do is cover everything, but if people want to do that, we would be really happy to support them in any way that we can. And I think, you know, here's an interesting thing. If you get 100 people to write to a company about a product or service, even if you get 50 of them to do it, and in the end, 25 or 30 of them actually do send an email, that will create a change for certain. That will create a change. It will get people to notice, you know, we can follow up when consumers have contacted the company, or we can contact them in collaboration. So I agree. I think, you know, one of the things all of us in this community need to do is to be more vocal and actually be saying to brands that aren't doing stuff, look at this, you know, you could do it. You know, one of the challenges, I guess, we have is that, you know, sometimes the legislation in the UK anyway doesn't allow us to go quite as far as our friends in America, for example, have been able to go. I think we're getting there, but we've got a stretch to go. But it's a great idea, and I would agree. I think just let's try and get, and Twitter is brilliant for this. Let's try and use Twitter to articulate, you know, lack of access, accessibility barriers, and let's hold people to account. Let's get people to come back and say, well, we've taken on board your concern, we've fed in your bug, we'll come back. And rather than just letting it go, let's go back and say, you know, we spoke a month ago or 2 months ago about my accessibility experience. Where are things at? How can we help you to move forward? And our stance has always been one of being able to collaborate and being able to support and help organizations. And that typically tends to be the approach that's kind of created the greatest spirit of collaboration. I think at an individual level, people will undoubtedly feel really frustrated and really, you know, hacked off by a negative accessibility experience. And we want to support them to kind of direct that energy and direct that experience at exactly the right place.
From our point of view, to build this here, I mean, the major shift in organisations wanting to make a change has happened over the last 12 months or so, with the public sector regulation coming into effect. So if we look back over the 9 years of GAAD being a thing, that pretty much coincides with the 10 years of the Equality Act being a thing. And the Equality Act obviously required organisations for the first time to be proactive in making things accessible. Up until that, and with the Disability Discrimination Act, if a disabled employee, for example, or customer came along and said, I can't use X, or I would need to use Y, as you know, if you hired me, then the organisation would be able to say, oh, well, I don't think we've got any blind customers, or I don't think we've got any dragon employees, and our systems don't work with that. So, you know, apologies. So that was a horrible catch-22 that, you know, existed with the DDA. The Equality Act then took that, you know, made it a requirement for organizations to be proactive. And, you know, in the 10 years since that came in 2010, obviously every system and program and process within an organization has been refreshed. So all of those should now come under that remit. Have they? No. I mean, have they become made accessible? Not really. I mean, in our estimation, we're still in kind of like single digits or low teen digits of percentage of accessibility across, you know, your average website, for example. Mm-hmm. And internal intranet applications are potentially even worse because, you know, they're not given the same level of priority because there isn't necessarily the same level of scrutiny that organizations like the RNIB have historically given when things go awry kind of in the customer facing realm. But then the public sector regulations, for the very first time, and to our government's credit, they brought it into effect as one of the last bits of legislation, EU legislations that they brought into the UK books before Brexit became a thing. For the very first time, that legislation named a body that would proactively start monitoring websites and other digital properties, you know, PDFs that organizations use, etc., and internal facing systems, only in the public sector, and that includes broadcasting and higher education and stuff like that. But nevertheless, you know, it was a really important, significant bit of legislation. And because for the first time, the EHRC was named as the monitoring body, the Cabinet Office as the body that would enforce it and potentially hand out fines. Wow. Fines, monitoring, reporting, those hit buttons that had never been hit before, because under the Equality Act, the government never thought that they should enforce it in any way, shape or form. It was just organizations like the RNIB who actually were making things happen. And whereas it's really important to advocate, to galvanize customers to focus on a particular company's app or website that isn't accessible, and hopefully that'll get traction and that website or app will become accessible because they'll get on board, you know, our campaigning will have worked. I really do think that the government needs to expand this legislation to other sectors as well, where the legislation actually has teeth, because otherwise you're not, well, you know, that's just one organization that has been affected by our advocacy, but we have been inundated by public sector organizations since this came in. And so the scale is just completely different. So that's definitely something that we would carry on advocating and asking other people to as well, to contact their local MP, to tweet, etc., to say, come on, guys, let's make the law have some teeth here. And I'm hoping that organizations like the RNIB, certainly AbilityNet, will be putting in regular freedom of information requests to the EHRC to say, okay, who have you monitored this month? How have they done? Let's publish those results. So naming and shaming, yeah, but you know, it really, really does make things happen. And we know that these are going to make better products for everyone. So let's just do it.
Now, we've got about 10 minutes left, and I want to use that time to look ahead a little bit, because this year we are going to see interesting new developments in technology. Of course, 5G is rolling out, and we'll see more of that, I guess, by the end of the year. A lot of products have been delayed or pushed back as a result of coronavirus, so we would normally at this point, I would imagine, be talking about, say, the first 5G iPhone, and that may come out this year, but it may be delayed until the beginning of next year. There's also talk that Apple will next year launch Apple Glass. Very interesting article from, is it John Prosser, Robin?
Yeah.
John Prosser.
One of the number one leakers.
Yeah, he's been very reliable, hasn't he? So,
Or tipsters, I should say. I don't know whether he's a leaker or not.
Yeah, no, well, one or the other, either way. Freedom fighter or, yeah, but anyway. I think we're seeing interesting developments in this space. And I guess the question again for all blind people is, will it work? Will it be accessible? What will the benefits for us be? Now, I hate to be an Apple fanboy about this, Robin Spinks, but, you know, if they've made everything else, including the HomePod, accessible, I can't imagine Apple Glass won't be.
I think there are very few companies that I would have a huge amount of confidence in saying they'll get this right. And even if they don't get it right straight away, they'll get most of it right and they'll refine it. And I think, you know, I remember being in the audience at a conference where Apple were speaking, and they were talking about the future in technology. And they were saying all the things that they typically say, which is, we don't answer questions about the future. We don't talk about products in the future. And that, you know, I respect that. I understand that's a It's a historical thing. It's part of Apple's DNA. The watch was about to arrive within about a month of that talk. And lots of people were asking the question, will it be accessible? And I think the presenter very ably said, look, if you listen to what it is that I'm saying, then the answer to that question was in there. And it was effectively saying, look, this is part of who we are as a company. It's something we care deeply about. We might not necessarily get it perfect the first time it launches, but we will work to refine it and make it better. And it's important to us from the word go that accessibility is part of all of our products. So personally, I'd be massively surprised if Apple Glass came to market without, you know, as much accessibility as is possible at that time. That doesn't mean to say that everything is going to be accessible, but I think what it is possible to do will be kind of pleasantly surprised by. That'd be my tip. Mm. And I'm sure it's something that a lot of work is underway, you know, on right now. Given that there is a framework, you know, there are operating systems that have accessibility as part of the plumbing of the operating system. It would be crazy, wouldn't it, to imagine a new operating system coming along that doesn't have that. And my goodness, they know that they would be in for a major pushback if that happened in 2021, you know, sort of 12 years after they'd launched accessibility on the iPhone.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to be accessible. But the question is, what will we use it for, Robin Christofferson? What are you thinking about? Because it doesn't have a camera in it. It's got, well, this is the rumor anyway. It won't have a camera. It will have a LiDAR sensor, similar to the iPad Pro.
Yeah, so the scattering of the little laser dots so that it can map the environment is what that will be. And obviously, it won't then have the privacy concerns, which is, I'm sure, why they've gone down this route, maybe from an energy efficiency point of view as well. I don't know. But yeah, John Prosser is saying that they're very sleek. They look like normal glasses. They have gone for the smart accessory approach rather than building a whole, you know, cell phone into your face as you have with Google Glass, for example. So it's very much a kind of a headset to your phone, which I think points to the accessibility side of things as well. Mm. You know, we know if you put any kind of Bluetooth headset on, then you're just going to get the accessibility of your phone kind of in your ears or wherever it might be. So hopefully it'll be a remote, almost camera that will be able to know a lot about what's going on around you. Now, both lenses apparently have a heads-up display built in, which, if you've got no useful vision, isn't going to be of use to you. The price point that he said was actually not an eye-watering one at all. So I think that we won't be paying over the odds for those built-in displays that we potentially wouldn't get any use out of if you've got no, you know, useful vision. But the fact that those heads-up displays exist, to me, points to the fact that they'll need to be a certain level of sort of resolution within the LiDAR so that you can map things accurately on what you're looking at. So, you know, if it's pointing to the entrance to the underground station, for example, or to the crossing or the intersection or whatever, that needs to be mapped on relatively precisely. And I think that does point to, in particular, near field objects, you know, things that are close to you, being mapped with very great accuracy, to the extent that we hopefully will be able to use your kind of seeing AI equivalents on there. So I'm supremely excited by this. And for people that have vision impairments that require prescription lenses, etc., yes, it will do that as well, apparently. So there's not going to be a kind of a sunglasses model and coming out initially. So this is for replacing, you know, your everyday glasses.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very exciting technology for sure. And I think that is the next step in wearables, I think, that we are going to be getting all excited about. I mean, the watch works really well. I love my Apple Watch and, you know, I love everything that I own with Apple, of course. I mean, I think everybody who knows this is the show for more than 5 seconds will get that. But, you know, that's just the way it is. But interestingly, we're seeing Google are developing more technology, new Pixel phone coming out. this year. Again, they're going to be shifting that price point a little bit to compete even more with the iPhone SE, which is driving forward an interesting thing. Now, Robin Spinks, when you and I were texting back and forward yesterday to set up for this show, you were sort of talking about this idea of, you know, the mid-range being premium rather than sort of a low-end option, I guess, for smartphones now. It seems to be changing gear a little bit with the iPhone SE and then the new Google phones.
That's right. I think we're seeing a really interesting shift where we're seeing kind of downward pressure from Google. So we're led to believe that Pixel 4a will introduce around £350 in the UK for a 128 gig. That's fantastic when you consider the potential that that phone offers. So downward pressure, get the pricing down to make it competitive against Apple's kind of affordable offer. But then also, you know, the top end of the range, the kind of Samsung Galaxy S20 Ultra, iPhone 11 Pro Max, etc., that whole segment that's well above £1,000 now, there's a lot of public opinion that would suggest that people just won't be prepared to pay that amount of money in the new world for devices, or at least fewer people will be happy to do that. So we're kind of seeing more affordable options at the lower price points, but there's this new category emerging that I would almost call the mid-range premium or the premium mid-range, and that would be your iPhone SE or your Google Pixel 4a, where for around about £400, you can have a device that does everything that your £1,000 plus device does, just without a few of the bells and whistles. And I think that's a really interesting progression and something that customers will welcome and will embrace. Yeah. You know, and in terms of the iPhone SE, there's a big portion of people who, for whatever reason, struggle with Face ID, or when wearing a mask, they're less confident that it's going to work. So, you know, Touch ID has come along on the iPhone SE at a really interesting time, I think.
Yeah, it certainly has. I mean, it's a really interesting time for technology. We haven't even got a chance to talk about smart TVs, the emergence of driverless vehicles, which, of course, is becoming more and more part of the conversation, the national conversation, getting into people's minds, not just blind people, but everybody, to you know, get people around to the idea of these kind of driverless pods, vehicles, whatever. It's a very exciting time. We are, unfortunately, out of time here on Tech Talk. But, you know, the three of us have got to do this again, because, you know, we do this every year for Global Accessibility Awareness Day. It's, you know, a great day, and, you know, lots of information about RNIB services available on RNIB's website, rnib.org.uk, and of course search for AbilityNet online as well if you want to find out more about the organisation that Robin works for. But yeah, we'll be back as always with another Tech Talk at the same time next week, and also on the podcast same time next time here on the podcast. So do check it out, and do keep in touch with us as well. We love to read out your emails, techtalk@rnib.org.uk. For now, though, can I just say thank you to you both for giving up an hour of your time for this. Robin Spinks from RNIB, Robin Christofferson from AbilityNet, as always, thank you guys.
Thanks, guys. Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
And like I say, we're back next time for another Tech Talk.